We turn then today to Romans chapter 3, verses 1 to 20. People by and large trust that as they have become acceptable to themselves, that they are indeed acceptable, and that they will be acceptable to God. Very few of us can continue living in the world of sanity if we not find ourselves acceptable to ourselves. We usually come to accept ourselves, whether with or without the warts we take notice of, but we find some way of coping with who I am and what I am and what value I have and what value I give to myself, and that I can learn to live with myself as I am. But because I can learn to live with myself as I am, and I don't disapprove of myself, I assume, therefore, that I am beyond disapproval. I assume that I really am all right, and that I will be all right with God also. Because, after all, if I come up to my own standards, I surely must come up to His standards. That is, there is a fundamental misunderstanding in people's perception of themselves. The moralist hopes that he will be good enough because he is better than the person next to him. He'll put his standard nearly always in terms of those around about him. Any absolute standard of morality will lead him to the idea that he is not satisfactory, that he is unacceptable. So, the standard of saying I am better than my neighbour is a good one, because I know that I am better than my neighbour, because after all, have you met my neighbours? Having seen my neighbours, you can see how easy it is for me to be better than my neighbours, and so it's an acceptable standard. There are a couple of chairs over this side if you want to walk straight across in front of us. It'll be much easier for us all, I think, in the long run. Now, that's the moralist hope. But, of course, that is a terrible misunderstanding, isn't it? For how can I really judge that I am better than my neighbour, seeing I do not know my neighbour's motives and I do not know the conditions of life he is under? And so what if I'm better than him, seeing he's so crook anyway, say I'm better than him, saying nothing? The problem also lies in the fact that we universally underestimate sin. We underestimate its seriousness. We underestimate our own commitment to it. A lady rang me some time ago who was very concerned about her life, very worried about her life and wanting help. She rang me because she was, in a sense, desperate and had nowhere else to go to. She had contemplated suicide. I talked to her for a while, quite a long while really, listening to her, and she protested that she had done nothing wrong in life. I suggested to her that that was not really the Christian understanding, that she will have done things that are wrong. And she says, well, the matter's about concerning me and God. I've done nothing to particularly hurt him, although, as it came out more and more clearly, she didn't really believe in him, and so she wasn't conscious of what he demanded and commanded of her. What she really meant to say was that she didn't hurt anybody else. She didn't live a life that purposely went around hurting other people. She was a fairly harmless person in that regard. However, one of her problems was that she had almost nothing to do with anybody else as well. That is why she wasn't hurting too many people. But she thought because she wasn't hurting too many people, she was not really doing anything that was wrong. We've often heard, as you've often heard, of people who say they have lived up to the Ten Commandments. But yet, when you test out what they mean by the Ten Commandments, they'll usually reduce it down to the last few. And when you talk about Jesus' explanation of the last few, they usually say that the Ten Commandments are not what's important anyway. To actually come to how serious our sinfulness is, we need to actually understand God and His ways and characters. If we don't believe in God, then we won't find sin very serious as a problem. But even if we do believe in God, and do believe therefore in sin, we underestimate our commitment to it. We believe that sin is something I do occasionally. Well, on an off chance, unpremeditatedly, when I slip, that is when I sin. We do not really take the Bible's view that we are committed, holus bolus, to sinfulness. We are like smokers who say that they can give it up if they want to, but they just don't want to. You've met smokers like that? It'd be very much more convincing if they did, wouldn't it? Very much more convincing. Now, I heard another one last night, didn't I? Someone who said that she can obey the Ten Commandments if she wants to, but she just chooses not to. Again, very much more convincing if she do the trick. We underestimate all the time how committed we really are to sin, even those of us who know the doctrine that all people sin. We still underestimate it. See, we're surprised when fellow Christians do things that are sinful. So how can that be? A fellowship leader that I had when I was a teenager, the fellowship leader I had was dismissed from the school in which he was a teacher because of immorality. It's devastating, isn't it? I tell you, it was devastating to us then. Devastating now, isn't it? Just to think of the possibility that that could happen to your fellowship leader. Why is it devastating? Because we don't really believe that people are sinful. That's why it's devastating. We really haven't committed to our understanding the idea that we as human beings are committed to sinning. That is our way in life. It is the natural air we breathe. Sin is just natural to us. In fact, if I want to do what is natural to me, I will sin. It's the character of us all. Or indeed, do you think it is impossible for Joe Jockey Peterson to be a Christian? Do you think that is impossible? It's a quick test here to see who votes Labour. do you think that is an impossibility? Because you see, some people do. I read magazine articles, even written by Christian people, who really find the policies and decisions that he has made of such nature as to be utterly inconsistent with Christianity, so that his Christianity is then held in question. Because no one could be that sinful and Christian. Well, now, I'm not saying I agree with his policies, nor am I saying I disagree with his policies. I'm not interested in that question one way or the other. You can sort that out later. What I'm interested in is seeing that our doctrine of sin is so watered down that we cannot conceive of someone being sinful and Christian, when the Bible would teach us that we must expect it. Or indeed, is it possible for Idi Amin to be converted? Or is he beyond hope? No point really ever preaching the gospel to him. He's gone too far. Well, he certainly has gone a long way. I have no difficulty in identifying what my attitude is to his policies. They've got a long, long way down the road of unrighteousness, without any shadow of a doubt. But if you think that he's too far down the road to be converted, it's because you don't realise yet how sinful you are. What you're saying is you're better than he is. You're no better than he is. You just haven't had the opportunities he's had. That's the difference. We're all just as sinful. We all face up to the same possibilities of selfishness, really. And the work of God in converting you is the same work that we involved in converting Idi Amin. No greater work, really. Now, the way in which I cope with my sinfulness, with my failures, is to excuse myself. And we all develop this as a fine art early on in life. One thing is to forget everything that we've ever done that's wrong. Forget it as quickly as you can, too. And whatever you do, don't let it surface to the consciousness again. Another is to lower God's standard and say, well, it's not really sin, one way. I mean, he didn't really think that was really wrong. Not really, really wrong. I mean, it's just a minor breach of an unimportant principle of a lower order, and it really doesn't matter all that much. I've had people challenge me and contend with me on the basis of the Revised Standard Version that fornication is not sin. Because if you go through the Revised Standard Version, there is not one verse in it which ever says that fornication is wrong. In fact, you'll find there's not one verse in the whole of the RSV that mentions fornication, because the translators think it's an old-fashioned word and they don't use it anymore. But there's a modern word which is an equal equivalent, and it's there. But because some people can't find fornication, they say, well, it's all right. It's not really wrong. And blind Freddy can work out what the Bible's saying on the subject. Easy as hills, but we'll actually try and lower God's standards so as to be able to cope with our inability to keep God's standards. Or alternatively, we'll compare ourselves with others, or we'll ignore the facts about ourselves, and we'll say, I am not a sinner, I do not sin, or I don't sin as much as other people. But one way or another, I will excuse myself, because it is intolerable to face up to myself as someone who is morally inadequate. Worse than inadequate, morally perverted. I can't live with myself like that. Now, this has become one of the longest introductions to the reading of a Bible you've ever heard. We do get there, but chapter 3 is really dealing with the subject of our sin in the first 20 verses, in the fullest treatment you get in the Bible. Last week we saw at the end of chapter 2 that being a Jew is one inwardly, not outwardly. Here is a great thump for true religion. While it's true religion in the sense that it's not what you do physically, it's not which club you belong to, which holy building you go to, which order of service you run through, all those things any twit can do, but it's how you are spiritually as a person that God looks, not on the outside, but on the heart, is the way God looks. But that viewpoint, it gives grounds for dispute. It's like this. If a true Jew is one inwardly, not one outwardly, then is the Old Testament wrong in establishing the nation Israel? Or why are there Jews? What is God trying to do in raising up a nation that really doesn't count for anything, seeing you can be in the nation without being in the nation if you've got it in the heart? And you might be in the nation physically, but not in the nation because you haven't got the heart right. I mean, what's the point of having the nation at all if there's no difference, Jew or Gentile, one way or the other? Or is God faithless to his word? He's raised up a nation, Israel, but he doesn't care two hoots about them. He's only interested in people who are circumcised in their heart. What is it, you see? Where do the Jews fit in then? And so, before Paul really makes his final concluding thump on the subject of sin, in verses 9 to 20 of chapter 3, he sidetracks with the Jewish question first. And it really does attack the excuses that a Jew will put up against Paul's argument. They're not particularly our excuses. They are hard to follow when you read them. But they are dealing with the excuses that can be put up with against the idea that Jew and Gentile alike is going to be judged by what is on their heart. Verses 1 to 8, and believe it or not, I'm now reading. Then, what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews are entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though every man be false, as it is written, that thou mayest be justified in thy words and prevail when thou art judged. But if our wickedness serves to show the justice of God, what shall we say? That God is unjust to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means. For then how could God judge the world? But if through my falsehood God's truthfulness abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying? Their condemnation is just. Here's the basic question. What is the advantage of being a Jew then? If you can be just as Jewish by having your heart circumcised, indeed being more Jewish. You expect the answer, none. There's no advantage in this wide world in being Jewish. But that's not the answer you get. Paul says the exact reverse. Much, much in every way is the advantage in being Jewish. Well, how can that be? Remember back last week, I pointed to you in verses 11 and 12 of 10 and 11 of chapter 2 actually look like a contradiction. For he says in 10 that God does good to the Jew first and then to the Greek. And goes on to verse 11 to conclude, because God shows no partiality. But while God is showing no partiality, he's treating the Jews first. Here it sounds as if there's no advantage in being Jewish, but there is, because God has done things for the Jews that he hasn't done for the rest of the world, such as giving them the oracles. They have the words of God. Now, in chapter 9, he'll give us some more advantages that the Jews have, but that's enough for starters here. That they are the ones to whom the words of God have been addressed, and so they are better off. Although the words of God are of such nature that it means they're also worse off. Because now I know what is right, I am all the more condemned for my failure. However, they are better off in that they're not ignorant. God has spoken to them. Well now, if I am faithless to what God has said, if I don't do what God has commanded me to do, does that mean now that God won't be faithful to his word either? And that's why there's no advantage in being Jewish. Oh no, says Paul, God is always faithful to his word. There's a series of puns here on the word faithfulness, which we can't pick up in the English because of verse 2. We can't get the word faithful in. But you can do it on trust, if you like, which is the same word. He says, much in every way. To begin with, the Jews are entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were untrustworthy? Does their untrustworthiness nullify the trustworthiness of God? Series of words the same there that Paul is punning on. If they are untrustworthy, no, God is still trustworthy. God will be true even though everybody be false. Even though we fail at every point, God will still be true to his word. Indeed, he must be that way so that his judgment will be seen to be just. So we won't be able to say to him, well, you didn't keep your word, I haven't kept mine, but you didn't keep yours, so you're not fair in judging me. Now, I want to look back to Psalm 51. God is just in condemning me as a sinner because he doesn't go back on his word and I go back on mine. Well then, two arguments flow out of that one. They're the same argument expressed twice, really. First one in verse 5, the second in verse 7. If that's so, if God's righteousness is being displayed in marked contrast to my sin, well then by sinning I'm doing him a good turn, aren't I? Because the more I'm sinful, the more he sees to be righteous, can be seen to be righteous. So that the blacker I become, the whiter he does. So why not really become very black? If not pitch black, so that he might be pearly, sparkling white, like some kind of toothpaste ad. Now, if my wickedness is to God's advantage, then his judgment of me is unfair. What rubbish, says Paul. God is the judge of all the world. It is axiomatic that his judgment will be fair. How can he be the judge of all the world if he is not being fair? So the contender with Paul, that Paul is imagining he's arguing with, puts forward another argument, but it's the same argument with different words. Verse 7, if through my falsehood God's truthfulness abounds to his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not do evil that good may come? Paul says, again, that is rubbish. Indeed, he doesn't argue with it this time. He just says the person who puts forward such a view has condemnation upon them, and their condemnation is exactly what they deserve, which is hardly an argument. I take it he's already argued with them on the idea of the justice of God. But he's just saying that's a totally perverted, twisted view of life. It's one that I understand Rasputin is reputed to have advocated, that you can't be saved unless you sin. So come and sin. That is what we should be doing. But it's one that Paul was falsely accused of. Now, how can that be? Well, it's very simple, really. And anybody who cares to proclaim the gospel that Paul proclaimed will be accused of it also. Let me put it to you in the extreme forms that I use from time to time to try and convey the idea of the gospel. And you will see how easily people can misunderstand me to saying that sin is a good thing, that we should be going out and doing it. Good people go to hell. The only people who ever go to heaven are bad people. You say that? Doesn't it sound like an encouragement to be bad? Or again, if you say that there is no good thing that you can do that will ever earn you the right to heaven, it is impossible. That the only thing that you ever contribute towards your salvation is your sinfulness. Doesn't that sound like an encouragement to go out and sin up, seeing that that is your big contribution? Or, Satan, the devil, wants you to be good. Because by getting you to be good, you'll be easily misguided into putting your trust in yourself rather than your trust in God. Now, each of those statements I've used, each of those statements I think are Pauline, given Australian flavour, but each of them are consistent with the gospel. They're actually true, all of them, but they are all open to the misunderstanding that sin doesn't matter, and indeed that sin's doing God a good service. And Paul says, it's slanderous. We're not saying that. Now, you also find it just in general terms that when you proclaim the gospel of justification by faith alone, people will say to you, does that mean I can go out and do anything? I could be a murderer and still be saved. And when you say yes, they say, well, it sounds immoral to me. And in their terms and categories, it is. You need to reflect sometime on the Christian Fellowship that meets at Long Bay Jail for weekly Bible study like ours. Because most people, you see, would find that absolutely contradictory with the idea of being Christian. How could you be a Christian if you're in Long Bay? No way you could be a Christian in Long Bay, is there? Well, that's not what the Christians in Long Bay feel, anyway. It's got to do with our misunderstanding of sin. But if I start going around saying, oh, of course you can be a prisoner, a thief, you could be a murderer, you could be all kinds, an extortioner, you could be a rapist, all kinds of things, and be a Christian. I can say that fairly easily. You can see how people will easily misunderstand it, saying, well, then what you do just doesn't matter. And I'm not saying that at all. Not at all. Indeed, what Paul goes on to say here is that it matters incredibly. Are we Jews any better off, he writes in verse 9? No, not at all. For I've already charged that all men, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have gone wrong. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave, they use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable. For no human being will be justified in his sight by works of the law, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Here is where Paul's argument is really leading. He asks the question then, does that mean the Jews are really better off? Well, that sounds like the same question as verse 1. But the answer is the exact reverse again. See, in verse 1, what advantage is there in being Jewish? Much in every way. In verse 9, well, are the Jews better off? No, not at all. He always seems to be trying to get both sides of the fence, doesn't he? Like the Church of England. You never rule out anybody as being heretical. Everybody's right, you see. So then nobody's wrong, are they? Now, Paul seems to be wanting both sides all the time. Well, the phrase no, not at all can be actually differently translated and fairly translated. Not in every way, which actually relieves that paradox slightly. But still, even taking it in the harder form that we find it in our Revised Standard Version, are the Jews any better off? No, they're not better off in the sense of the judgment that comes upon them from God. They're better off in that they've got the words of God. But if they sin, they get exactly what anybody else gets. No more, no worse. He can't say, well, having the law of God doesn't matter. It does matter. It's a tremendous advantage. But you mustn't go back and say, well, I've got the law of God, therefore what I do doesn't matter. That is what he's already attacked in chapter 2. They're no better off at all when it comes to the subject of sinning. For Jew and Greek alike are under the power of sin. Men are not free. All have turned back on God, and they all do what they want to do, which issues in wrongdoing in a whole range of areas. And to demonstrate that, Paul adduces six passages from the Old Testament. Notice the way in which we are said to be under the power of sin. The Bible never really views men as being totally free. Anyone who sins, says Jesus, is a slave to sin. Now you can easily check that out, can't you? For that's a little bit like the slavery to any drug, you see. You may not feel that you're enslaved to it, but you just try and stop using it for a while, and you find out the nature of your bondage. People say, oh, well, I'm not enslaved to sin. I can stop any time I want to. All right, well, stop for a while and see how you get on. The withdrawal symptoms are murder, let me tell you. You might last out 10 minutes, 15, but you'll find it impossible to really go cold turkey on the subject of sin. For we really are in bondage to the thing. Now that is not to say that I don't make up my mind to do it. Not to say like the Skinnerians, I can't help it, I've just been programmed this way. Every time I do that which is wrong, I do it. Sure, I might be pushed, but I also jump. And in the last analysis, I can always be held responsible for doing the jumping. And in that sense, the Bible would say that I'm free. But in the sense of thinking that I actually am somebody who can stop sinning sometime, we are under the power of sin, says Paul. We are all under sin, under it. Now, the verses that he lists here are Psalm 14. I listed them on the yellow sheet, but I haven't actually told you which one relate to which. Your cross-references would do that in any standard Bible, but as you may not have them with you. Psalm 14, verses 1 to 2, which are identical to Psalm 53, verses 1 to 2, are quoted by Paul in verses 10 to 12 of Romans 3. It's not referring to Gentiles, it's referring to all people are in that category, really. Psalm 5:9 and Psalm 140, verse 3, are combined and quoted in verse 13. Psalm 10:7 is quoted in verse 14. Both verse 13 and verse 14 talk about the ungodly who attack us. Isaiah 59, verses 7 to 8, is quoted in verses 15 to 17, which speaks of the nation Israel in their sinfulness. And Psalm 36, verse 1, is quoted in verse 18. There from all the scriptures, says Paul, this is the judgment of scriptures. This is what men and women are like. We are sinful through and through. And you read through that and you say, none is righteous, no, not one. All right, that's everybody. Okay, all have turned aside, they've gone wrong. Throat is an open grave, they use their tongues to deceive, the venom of asps is under their lips, their mouth is full of curses and bitters. Oh, that's a bit rough, isn't it? I mean, I'm sinful, yeah, but venom of asps under my tongue, my lips, and curses and bitterness, and that's really going a bit strong in the language that's used to me. Well, just check ourselves out here and have a show of hands for anybody who has never, ever said something that was deceitful. Anybody here who's never ever said something that was unkind and hurtful about somebody else? Here's the opportunity for someone who's dumb to indicate it by putting their hand up, you see. But that's about the limit of it, isn't it? What Paul says is the character of us, that such is our sinfulness, that we use the tongue to lie and to slander and to attack people viciously and unkindly. And it's universal. Everywhere people are doing that. All over the world, people are saying nasty and unkind things about people. But you say, well, it's not. Yeah, that's true, but it's not all the time. I mean, occasionally. Just rarely. Every now and then when I've got a slack moment and I don't think too hard, I say something nice about somebody. You can't say that I'm always saying something nasty about people. James in his fourth chapter says, yeah, that just shows how perverse you are. You're like a spring that puts forth both sweet water and sour water, bitter water at the same time. There you're praising God and cursing man who is made in the image of God. I mean, it just shows how twisted and gnarled you are, that you cannot use that which God has given you for good, but constantly you're using it for evil and for distortion, half praising, half cursing. You cannot believe anything that is being said by you. Our tongues are like that, and our feet really are swift to shed blood. Remember the words of Jesus. He says, if you hate a man, you already murdered him. The reason why most of us don't do the murdering activity is because the police are around. There's all kinds of social restraints that help us, enable us to live. But throughout the world, men are swift to shed blood, aren't they? Which country do you want to pick outside Australia? Which one? I mean, Cambodia? Conservatively estimated that somewhere between a quarter and a third of Cambodia have been killed in the last 3 years. It's a lot of people, isn't it? I mean, it was 8 million people before they started. You want to pick another country? You want to pick the Middle East? You want to pick Ethiopia and parts of Africa? Oh, you don't like the northern parts. Well, let's run down to the southern part. That's not too good either. We'll go over to the Congo. That's not really crash hot either. Well, where are you left with? Men are very swift to shed blood. Very, very swift to shed blood. All around the world, men are swift to shed blood. That's what Paul said. That's what we are like. And that's what the Old Testament says we are like. We are sinful because we do not fear God. That is not the character of people, to come into this world fearing God and wanting to do that which is godly. The character of people to want to do what we want to do, and what we want to do, because it is a denial of God, will run us into sinfulness. It will run us to the expression of our sin. And he goes on, for we know that whatever the law says, verse 19, it speaks to those who are under the law. That is, I take it he's using the word law there to mean the whole Old Testament, which he can use. The word law he uses in quite varied ways. In F.F. Bruce's little commentary on Romans, you'll find that in the introduction there are six or seven different ways that the word law is used in the Epistle to the Romans alone. Several different ways it's being used. Well, You Jews, you are the ones who want to be under the law. See, what is the advantage of the Jews? They've got the oracles of God. They say, see, God so loved us that he sent us his words. We alone, of all the people of the world, we've got the words of God. He says, all right, you want to be the people with the words of God? Listen to what the words of God have got to say because they've been given just for you. Well, that's a different story. Because when you read the words of God, you see what they say, don't you? They say that you're sinful. That's what they say. That the words of the law actually come so as to convict them that they are sinful. You see, you want to cry innocent. That is what we want to cry. The Jew wants to cry it in terms of, well, all these people, the psalmist is writing about, they're the Gentiles, they're the wicked sinners, they're the barbarians, pagans, they're not the Jews like us. But the oracles are for us. For do we not do these very things? In fact, we want the Word of God to be written for us. That's our claim, that we've got the Word of God. It's not written for the Gentiles, it's written for us, to describe us. You know that, and I know that, when we read down the Psalms, don't we? I always take the position of the man who's the godly one who's being attacked by the ungodly, and I look around for those people who are attacking me. There are those verses which apply to me, like righteous, and there are those verses which apply to them, like unrighteous. And so I've got the words of God, haven't I? I just don't let it actually come near my conscience anywhere, lest it hurt me. And that's what is so easy to do. He says, no, no, if you've got the word of God, then it is for you. And it's for you that your mouth might be stopped. You've got nothing to answer back. So that not even the Jews are right by the word of God. Therefore, by definition, the whole world's wrong by God, and the whole world will be held accountable to God. See, it doesn't matter that some people say, well, I don't feel guilty. That's not what he's saying. He's saying you're held accountable to God, not to your feelings. You may feel guilty, you may not feel guilty. You may feel guilty because you have stood on a crack on the way out. That's no indication of whether you're guilty or not, is it? It's an indication you've got a psychological problem of fairly severe magnitude. But it's no indication that you're guilty. Not going to be held accountable to my feelings of guilt, but held accountable to God. You say, but my conscience is clear. Well, that isn't irrelevance. That just tells you how twisted your conscience is. Conscience is like any computer. You can program it to give out any answer you want it to give out. Whatever you feed in one end, it'll pop out the other end. So my conscience is clear. That's not what he's talking about. He's not saying that you're going to be held accountable by your conscience, but you're going to be held accountable by God. You say, well, I haven't broken the law of the land. It doesn't matter. If you've broken the law of the land, you'll be held accountable by the law of the land. But if you've broken the law of God, whether you know it or not, you'll be held accountable by God. You say, well, I don't believe in God. Well, that's the last great stupidity of all time. Say, because I don't believe in God, I won't be held accountable by him. It's a great absurdity. If he's not there, well, then you're not going to be held accountable by him. But if he is there, then whether you believe in him or not is an irrelevance, isn't it? That's like saying, well, I don't believe the world's round, I believe it's a cube. Now, I can believe that if I want to, but if it happens to be round, then I take it that most of my understandings of the nature of our world will be wrong. Say nothing of the terrible complications I'm going to have in trying to work out how to get out of the corners. All that will be wasted intellectual endeavour, because the corners aren't there. The fact that I believe it is one thing. It's irrelevant to its reality. If God is there, I am going to be held accountable by God for what I have done wrong. And what this passage says in verse 19, it could not be clearer. The whole world is going to be held accountable to God. Every individual in the world is going to be held accountable to God. For all people have failed. And so he goes on to say, no one is justified. Nobody is justified. Again, in God's sight. And many a man will be self-justified. Many a man will be able to find excuses for himself. That's neither here nor there. But in God's sight, by God, no one can stand righteous. He's reflecting Psalm 143, verse 2 there, although not quoting it directly. He says, and no one will be righteous by the law, for the law declares all men equally guilty. You cannot be any more sinful than sinful, and we're all sinful. You cannot be more of a lawbreaker than a lawbreaker, and we're all lawbreakers, and therefore all held accountable by the law of God, and no one stands justified by the law of God, justified in God's sight, since all the law does is identify sin. That's what it does. It's not all that it does. I've overstated the case there, for later in Romans he'll give us some other things it does. But one of its primary functions is to give us knowledge of sin. It identifies sin. You see, I don't know that telling lies is sin or not sin. Then I read the Bible. Lying lips are an abomination unto me, says the Lord. Now I know. The difference between me before I read the Bible and the difference and after I read the Bible is not that I wasn't a sinner and now I am a sinner. The difference was I was a sinner without knowing the precise nature of it, and now I'm a sinner and I know the precise nature of it. So what has the law done for me? It's given me knowledge of sin. It's taught me what is right and what is wrong. And it has identified my disease in all its symptoms. It's shown it up for me. It commits me and convicts me of my sinfulness. That's what it does. That is why you can rest assured that anybody who's so stupid as to say they just live by the Ten Commandments, or they just live by the Sermon on the Mount, hasn't read it lately. Because if you read it, you would never come to such a stupid statement. For if you read it and take account of what the law says, what the Sermon on the Mount says in the New Testament category of law-keeping, if you read the thing, then you'll be convicted that you don't live by it, that you fail at almost every point. That is the purpose and exercise of reading the thing out loud in church from time to time, so as to remind people that they do not keep the Word of God, and that they do not stand right with God on the basis of law, and to identify for people where they are falling down now. Then our understanding of sin is like this. It's a God question. If you want to do away with sin, do away with God. The only trouble is he might be there, and then there's no advantage to you in the slightest. But if you haven't got God, if there's no God, there's no sin. There's no meaning, there's no value, there's no righteousness, there's nothing else either, I may say. We're just a poor, unfortunate blobs. But sin is ultimately against God. It is universal in that we are all caught up in it, each and every one. When I say it's universal like that, it's very easy for me to say, yeah, the whole world's sinful. But what I'm trying to really need to say is, I am sinful, as I am part of the universe. I'm part of that group called humanity. I personally am sinful. For I personally do not worship the Lord my God with all my heart, all my strength, all my soul, which is the first and great commandment. As I break the greatest commandment, I don't have to worry about lesser ones, do I? I mean, how could you get any greater a sinner than breaking the greatest commandment? And I personally have done that. Now, at that point, you're sitting there and saying, oh, well, I know that. Philip Jensen's sinful. Right? You are sinful. I mean, I'm not as rude as to point the finger and say you. I'm saying I, so that you'll get the general drift to say it of yourself too, that we must see that we are committed to sinfulness, each one and every one of us. That is our natural state. And none of us are or ever will be or ever have been acceptable to God by the way we've lived. You cannot get right with God by obeying his law and his commandments. For one thing, you've got to eradicate all the wrong things you've already done. But even if you shut your eyes on those for a little while, living on, you will only find that you'll do more and more wrong. No one ever is right with God by keeping the law. Do you think I'm kind of going over that same point? Of course, Paul goes over the same point over and over again, because it is the one point that people will not understand. And I tell you for why they won't understand it. Because you can't live with that knowledge, can you? How can you live genuinely believing in God and genuinely believing that you are out of step with him and can't get right with him? That makes life intolerable to live under that tension. I am wrong with God, and not only am I not getting right with him, but I can't get right with him. It's easy to say there's no God. It's easy to say, oh, I'm not sinful. It's easy to say sin doesn't matter. It's easy to say anything but to face up to that reality. But yet that is the fact. There's not one person here who has lived up to his own standards, let alone to God's standards. We mustn't bull on and pretend we're better than we are. We all are moral failures, purposeful and intentional and premeditated in our failure as well. Every one of us face the reality. We cannot get right with God. And I am one like that. Now, if you think that's a fairly depressing view of human nature, I'd say it is, but it's a realistic view. And if you say, but Philip, I can't keep on living with that view of human nature, I say, well, you must come back next week, because I tell you, verses 21 to 29 actually give you the answer as how a man can get right with God. But if you say, I cannot live for a week under that kind of tension, then I reckon you better come and see me right pronto and get right with God. For God will actually get me right with Him. Not by pulling myself up from the shoestrings. That's not the way. Not by obedience to the law. But by a far more remarkable, marvellous way than we've ever dreamt of or thought of. Indeed, it's so clever that only God could have ever thought it up. It's in the next few verses. Read ahead for your preparation. But if you really are troubled by it, and indeed if you know, if you're not sure that you are right with God, you should be troubled by it, then I hope you'll take the advantage of coming and talking to me about it sometime.